He said it's not only about what we were made to be in the first place, but what we will become in the future, in the new creation. But there's a problem. Between the bookends of the past and the future, the image of humanity as glorious and great and ruling over everything is not obvious. And the writer of Hebrews goes on in verse 8. He says this is his comment on Psalm 8. He says, in putting everything under them, God has left nothing that is not subjected to them. And then he adds this, yet at present we do not see everything subject to them. There's a problem. I'll say more about this in a minute, but for now it's enough to say that despite the extraordinary advances in knowledge and our best aspirations as human beings to do good, and despite 2,000 more years since the writing of Hebrews to get it right, humanity is not in a great place. In spite of having been made in the image of God, we are not in a great place. Even the most powerful are not very good at doing good, even though they have the power to do it, even though they may want to. More than this, no matter where we look, we'll not find one person who measures up to this picture of humanity. Given all the evidence, Psalm 8 seems to be giving us a false image of humankind, because as the writer of Hebrews says, this is not what we see. We don't see humanity great in this way. But, says the writer of Hebrews, in verse 9, he says, we do see Jesus. He was made like us, lower than the angels. Now he is crowned with glory and honour. And although it's not stated that God has put everything under his feet, it is strongly implied when the writer says that Jesus has won the ultimate victory. He goes on and says, he suffered death, so he was made flesh and blood in order to suffer death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. In other words, he conquered death, not only for himself but for everyone. Now let me tell you, if you want someone who is good at getting things done, get someone who can beat death. The point here is that everything is under his feet. Death is under his feet. Sin is under his feet. Everything is under his feet. Now, we could say a lot more about this, but let's just leave it at this. If you want to know what it means to be human, to be truly human, look at Jesus Christ. Look at this man who went about doing good. Look at this man who was completely in control of sickness and disability. He was completely in control of natural forces. He was completely in control over death. He was completely in control of every circumstance that he found of him and of himself in every circumstance. He never did or said anything out of place. He left nothing undone or unsaid that needed to be said or done. And he took responsibility for the welfare and the destiny of all people. This is the man who said, come to me, all you who labour and are heavy laden, heavy and are burdened, and I will give you rest. How many people are included in that invitation? Everyone. You know, I mean, we can barely give our own family rest. True? He gives this to all. Everything is under his feet. He fits the picture of Psalm 8. And as strange as it might seem, we were made to be like him. Not as he was as God, but fully human. Truly human people. And I'll talk about that again a bit more later. For now, a question and something to think about. And the question is this: how do you see yourself? Now, I know the cultural thing is, oh, well, you know, I'm not very good at this and I'm not very good at that. I know there's a kind of natural, or there's an enculturated humility in the Chinese community, which has its good side. How do you see yourself? What do you think of humanity at large? And I'm asking this not because I'm speaking to a Chinese group, but because I'm speaking to Christians. Because as Christians, we often define what it means to be human in terms of our sin and our propensity to die, well, more than the propensity, the inevitability of death. We don't often think about what we were made to be. So this is where I want to start. I want us to start at the point where we see what we were made to be. In the first few centuries after Jesus came, Christians thought this about this a lot more than we do. I can tell you a lot more. One Christian leader, about a little more than 100 years after Christ, wrote this. He said, "The glory of God is the human person fully alive." He actually pinned the glory of God as reflected in the image of God. This man, this particular bishop, Irenaeus, majored on this idea that the glory of God was seen in a perfected humanity, which was in Christ, but is going to be in us. About 200 years later, another Christian leader, Gregory, a bishop of a place in Turkey called Nyssa, he wrote a book called The Making of Man. And in that book, he begins by calling humanity a great and precious thing. He doesn't begin by sort of excoriating our sin. He begins by saying that we are a great and precious thing. And he said that man was not brought in the world to be rejected as worthless, but was destined to be king over God's creation, to enjoy God and to know his power, which is beyond speech and language. The New Testament also emphasizes the purpose and goal of human creation a lot more than we do. We read the text through certain eyes, but if you read it carefully, it emphasizes what I'm talking about strongly. So here's what I want us to think about. We face the problem of sin and death every day, in others and in ourselves. And it's easy to be clouded by that and discouraged. What if we thought more about God's purposes and goal in making us human in the first place? And the goal of that in the end. What if we saw every person not merely as a sin problem to be solved, but as Gregory put it, a great and precious thing destined to rule? Now, it's hard to get this mindset because of the conditions we live in and our understanding of ourselves. But this is actually what Scripture says. It's there in black and white in Psalm 8. Crowned with glory and honour, everything under our feet. Not now, but promised. In every human activity, just this is just an encouragement to start thinking this way. In every human activity, people who make a difference are not those who get bogged down in the problem or with problems and solutions. They're people who focus on the goal. Just look at any organisation. The ones who actually get things done are the ones who focus on the goal, not on the problem and how do we sort this out. When I was teaching at Trinity, I came into a very small music department and not very good. I stood up for my first orchestra rehearsal and I thought, what is this? But from the very beginning, my determination was not to look at the problem, but to look at my goal, which was to have a symphony orchestra of, you know, I figured about, you know, 50, playing Beethoven's symphony or something like that. We ended up an orchestra of about 80 by the time I left, and with six orchestras in the school and so on and so forth. And that could not have happened if I'd just been bogged down in the problem. I had to see the goal. Now, I'm going to say something to you as a church. It is going to be so easy for you to be bogged down in the problem and trying to just struggling to find the solutions. What is the goal? What is the goal? I mean, ultimately, the goal is glory and the glory of God's kingdom. But what is the goal of CABC in that kingdom and that process? That's the only thing that's going to motivate. That's the only thing that's going to get you through. To look at the goal. And listen to what Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 12. Because Jesus did this. It says, "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. He scorned its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Just think of that. Now, I'm not sort of saying what conclusions you as individuals or as a church need to come to. I'm simply saying that each one of you and you as a church as a whole need to be oriented towards the goal. And the goal is the gospel of Christ. The goal is a glorious humanity in Christ. The goal is the sanctification of God's people. Lots of goals. That's where you need to look. Okay, so that's looking at Jesus. Second thing is let's take a step back and look at humanity as it is. There is still the day-to-day reality that we have to face. Psalm 8 reassures us that God has made us for glory and honour, completely in control of ourselves and our environment, and a general blessing to everyone and everything that we deal with. But the writer of Hebrews is spot on when he points out that looking at humanity as we are here and now, this is not how it is. Again, verse 8, "At present we do not see everything subject to them." And what makes it worse is that we all feel, I think not just Christians, but every human being feels that this is not how it should be. Somehow this is not right. We have a deep-seated feeling that things should be better than they are. Look, it's not only Christians who see this problem, who see the gap between our hopes and the realities of everyday life. Every religion, in some senses, is an attempt to deal with forces that we're too weak to handle alone. And even leaving religion out of it, just look at the recent floods. They reveal two things. One, the goodwill of the majority of people, the vast majority of people, to help and do good. It's kind of Psalm 8 in action, actually, to some extent. It is Psalm 8 in action. But there's also disappointment and hurt, because we don't see everything subjected to us. Instead, we see our impotence. And I think all of us are feeling this at the moment. Even if your gutters are overflowing, and I actually found a vine growing out of one of my gutters the other day, and I thought, my goodness, what's going on? I've obviously neglected that side of the house for way too long. Natural forces, we're powerless in the face of them. The inability of our systems to cope with human tragedy. You know, there are all these complaints about the government's not doing enough, or this is not doing enough, or insurers are not insuring enough. There is no system that could be put in place that could handle it perfectly. As much as people may be able to be criticised for not doing it well enough, it could never be done perfectly. And we feel the frustration of that, and then the failure of government to get it right, and then, worst of all, the sinfulness of people who will take advantage of the vulnerable with looting or whatever, scam calls, anything like that. And then the fact of death, the ultimate wrong that can never be made right in the world as it is. It's been so sad seeing, you know, some of the people in those flood zones just having lost loved ones. And, you know, clearly, you know, this is a tragedy. It's an awful thing. The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre wrote this: "Man is a being to whom something happened." Now, his reasoning was not biblical. Sartre was an atheist, a very honest one, actually, and sometimes worth reading. But even though he's an atheist, his way of putting our situation is actually helpful. Man is a being to whom something happened. At some point in history, in the history of humanity, things have not worked out. They've not worked out as expected. Something's gone wrong. And since that time, our expectations of what we should be fall short of the reality falls short of our expectations of what we should be. And it's not hard to see. Look at humanity over the past few years. Take COVID. The rapid development of vaccines is actually Psalm 8 in action, isn't it, Ian? I mean, you'd agree with that. We know that this gift of scientific knowledge is a gift that God has given. And it's part of what it means to be human that we're able to act in this almost godlike way. Yet despite that, all of us are more aware than we were 3 years ago of how vulnerable we are to a natural force that we do not control. We've seen humanity at its worst, at its best and its worst. We've seen medical staff putting their lives on the line, working unworkable hours for others. We've seen good governance. But at the same time, we've seen some leaders make decisions that have been narcissistic, self-serving, and essentially almost genocidal. We've seen the internet transformed into a web of lies and misinformation. And what about Ukraine? We see a nation that was at peace little more than a week ago, attacked for the ambition of at least one man and probably and definitely more. And probably not just men either. There are women involved in that group around Putin. We've seen other nations act in goodwill and yet inconsistently, with no real power to stop what is happening, because we're afraid of our own backyard. I mean, you know, this is not an easy solution. Man, as Sartre said, is a being to whom something happened. Something's gone wrong. And look closer at home. How well do the people around you live up to your expectations of them? And even closer to home, how far do we fall short of our own expectations of ourselves? We all have expectations. We have expectations that we will be competent in our work, that we will live with integrity, that we'll live with moral courage and uprightness. There are things that we feel should be the case, standards that should be met by ourselves and by others, things that measure up to what it means to be a functioning person. And, you know, Psalm 8 kind of gives us that idea of what it means to be human, to be fully functioning. And yet this is not what we see. We're not always competent and rarely in control. And we often find ourselves thinking and saying and doing things that reflect a dark side of our nature that we would rather not see. One of the fathers of psychoanalysis, Carl Jung, observed that as human beings, we will do anything, no matter how ridiculous, to avoid looking into our own souls. That's almost a biblical definition of what it means to be a sinner. You know, Jeremiah, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, and who can know it? It's almost an exposition of that verse. The pain of self-knowledge is too great. We're powerless to do with ourselves or the world enough to make enough of a difference. In the end, we're powerless in the face of death. Lives that have been full of love and meaning and purpose are gone in a moment. And very soon, it is as if we have never been. Psalm 103 gives an illustration of, you know, the wind passing through a wheat field. That's what human life is like. You see the ruffle on the surface and then it's gone. And this is the dilemma that confronts us in Hebrews 2. It's not, and I want to emphasise this, it's not that the Bible doesn't teach that we are inherently sinful. Please, if you think that, that is not correct. What it does teach is that although we aspire to great things, we don't make it. We've been made in the image of God, but the image has been distorted. It teaches us that although the longing of Psalm 8 burns in our hearts, this is not our experience. Man is a being to whom something happened, and the writer of Hebrews tells us what it is in verse 14. He says that we're children of flesh and blood whose strength is not enough in the face of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil. Now we're really getting on to Christian understanding here. We don't live in a neutral world. We live in a world that is God's world, but there is one who holds the power of death. And we are powerless in the face of that being. And verse 15 tells us that the devil holds us in slavery by our fear of death. And then verse 16 goes on to make it clear that the problem of sin also needs to be solved. We need atonement. We need forgiveness. Because falling short of expectations as we do, we're cut off from ourselves and from each other and from the source of all life in God himself. This is the dilemma. God has made us in his image to be like him. We were created for glory. You, now I want you to put your name on this. You were created for glory. Winona, as you were reading this, Winona was created for glory. Dawn, as you're singing. Jane, as you're playing. Any one of you, as you're sitting here, you were created for glory, but the image has been defaced. The devil has distorted it and wishes to destroy what God has made, and we have lost our way. And the first step back is to acknowledge the reality of who we are and what we have become. And who we are those two things, made for glory, but fallen and broken. And since this is the start of I've been told that this is the start of a series of sermons on relating to Lent, a season that Christians call Lent. It's not a very Baptist thing, so it might be foreign to you, but it's basically a time of fasting and preparation for Easter, for Good Friday and Easter. And in that context, I've got nothing against it myself. In that context, I want to suggest that for all of us, this is a good time to reflect on ourselves. Baptists are sceptical about fasting as if it's kind of about earning brownie points. But, you know, we're flesh and blood, and giving up something is a helpful way to focus more and to see ourselves more clearly and to see God more clearly. Not just to beat up on ourselves, or not to do that at all, but simply to reflect and be honest and do that work that is so difficult of looking into our own souls. It's been said that conviction of sin is recognising that I'm not the person I thought I was. Have you ever had that realisation? This is not who I thought I was. If you're not a Christian, this is a good time for you to prayerfully and honestly think about who you have become and who you really are. If you are a Christian, knowing ourselves is the ongoing process of our growth in God. This is work we need to do. As I said, not to beat up, but to know. For the world, the work of self-understanding must be done, because humanity will be the origin of every evil that is coming. No question about it. As glorious as we were made to be, we will be the origin of all evil that comes into the world. Motivated, of course, by the devil. So this brings us to the ultimate meaning of Hebrews 2, which is for us to again just look back at Jesus. In this no man's land between God's original creation and the promise of a new creation, between the promise of Psalm 8 and the grubby reality of daily experience and the helplessness of human struggle with sin and death, we see Jesus. We see him as the true and only example of a true humanity. We see him as the victorious human, overcoming sin and defeating death. And we see him doing what we cannot do for ourselves. Now, the passage explains this in four ways, and these are not long, so don't despair or go to sleep just yet. There are four ways. The first way is Jesus is our brother. Verse 10 describes a family of many sons and daughters, and Jesus has made himself, or was made, part of this family. Verse 14 tells us that since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared our humanity. As part of that family, he's not the distant older brother who enjoys all of the benefits and takes no responsibility. You know the kind of older brother I might be talking about, even if it's not your older brother, hopefully. He's the older brother who comes close to us and suffers for us. Verse 11 tells us that he is not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters. Wow. Isn't that extraordinary? Just compare this for a moment to the older brother in Jesus' story about the lost son. The older brother stays at home when his younger brother leaves. He does nothing to intervene. He does nothing to bring him back. All's okay for him. That's his choice. Off you go. And when he comes home, he complains. And he is ashamed to call him his brother. Jesus is not like this. He came to us as our brother, taking on himself the burden and the responsibility of our lostness, so that even in the worst degree of human sin, he is not ashamed. I want to emphasize that one as well. In the worst degree of human sin, in the worst degree of your sin, he is not ashamed to call you his brother or sister. Without exception and without qualification, he is not ashamed to own you. Second, Jesus is our pioneer. He's the pioneer of our salvation, it says in verse 10. As our pioneer, he leads us through the jungle of life into the open spaces of God's kingdom. He takes us on a journey that no one has ever taken. He takes us by a path that we could never cross. The jungle is so dense, the problems are unimaginable. There's no map. And already, he's always ahead of us. He's always beating his way through the jungle of sin, through the valley of death, until he arrives safely at the goal and brings us safely to our goal himself. And he's done this for all humanity, By the grace of death, by the grace of God, he has tasted death for everyone, and he does it now for each one of us who trust him. And trust includes commitment and follow, doesn't it? Trust includes follow. Trust is not just believing things about him. He's cutting the path, and we're on his tail. He's our pioneer. Third, Jesus is our high priest. A priest is a person who represents others before God. He speaks for them. He argues their case, just like a lawyer argues a case in court. In the Jewish temple, the high priest was the big guy. He was the one who once every year offered a sacrifice to atone for the sins of the people, which is what is talked about in verse 16. Literally what atone means for, if you break the word up, it means to make us at one with God. A broken relationship brought back together again. Later in verses 17 and 18 give this role to Jesus in a way that is unique. Now, later on in Hebrews, the writer points out that it's unique in another way, that unlike any Old Testament priest, Jesus doesn't need to repeat the sacrifice. When he offered himself, once was enough. And that by one offering, he has made us perfect forever. You don't have to keep revisiting the offering. You don't have to keep beating yourself up. The sacrifice has been made. It is enough for you and for me. But here his emphasis is on the humanity of our high priest. This is not a God who has kept his distance. Verse 17, for this reason, he had to be made fully like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God. And in Jesus, God fully entered human experience. What a God to have. In Jesus, God has fully entered our human experience, even in temptation and suffering. So in verse 18, because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. He is our perfect representative. Now that's close. It's not just someone who comes to your side and gives you a little hug when you're hurt. He suffered. And he is able to comfort and to help you in every situation. Fourth, Jesus did all of this by dying. This is completely counterintuitive. Think for a moment about the words the writer of Psalm 8. Crowned with glory and honour, everything placed under his feet. Now, if you think about those words in worldly terms, crowned with glory and honour, everything placed under his feet, power like this is closer to a Roman emperor than to a man crucified on a lonely hill outside Jerusalem. Yeah? In modern terms, we could apply it in various degrees to any form of government or business or any other activity. I mean, we know what it's like, even in our workplaces. The aim is always to get on top. And if necessary, to use force or deceit or whatever to get there. Dictators, democratic leaders alike, exalt themselves. But Jesus was made a little lower than angels.